Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later. Welcome to issue 199 of the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans. It's Saturday, and it's the, first weekend of the month, which means it's time, or is it the second weekend of the month already?
Unless it's
I guess
not.
It depends.
You might be.
Hello, future people.
That's right.
And all the ships at sea.
From the world of the future, we will tell you about the plot of a movie that came out of a book that was 57 years ago.
We have this.
After
this thing that we have been.
And the snake is Titanic.
We have not been. Keeping up on this, we should have done one in February and we missed it, and we should have done one in April and we just missed it by a week because we got a little crazy. But the idea behind this episode is once a month we're going to be taking a look at a piece of prose book, you know, something that doesn't have pictures in it unless there are pictures just to illustrate certain ideas or facts, but books that are not comic books, to explore some different regions. And again, This spilled out of the growing stack of books that are next to my chair or next to the bathroom or next to the bed or whatever of things that I've been buying over the years because I'm like, oh, this sounds great. I want to read it. And then, of course, it just gets into the pile and gathers dust. So I've been forcing myself to try to read books. In February, I picked up the Chinatown Death Cloud Peril from Paul Malmont. The book came out in 2007. Rodrigo had gotten me hooked on, and I've seen the movie a billion times, The Maltese Falcon. And he said, hey, you know, I read that in like one night because it was so awesome.
Oh, yeah.
And so I said, okay, well, I know I have that book floating around here somewhere. We'll read that for the month of April. And so we decided to mash these two together into one giant noir pulpy episode. So before we get into our conversation about each of these books, Matthew, what do you like about... or maybe you don't like noir or pulp tales?
I like noir and pulp tales when they're done well. And a lot of times, honestly, for me, that means when they are actually pulp era.
Right.
A lot of the pastiche that has come around recently doesn't appeal to me. I like that whole first person narrative of, you know, a character who is obviously human and obviously has faults. And Sam Spade is, you know, very clearly the archetype of that, you know, that nosy gumshoe with a heart of gold who may, you know, the Rockford archetype.
Rockford's
is
the same way.
The closing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. he would be like noir detective of the 70s.
Right. I think I kind of like the whole, you know, the kind of, yeah, it was raining in the city that day. It was a hard rain.
Right.
I love that. And I, every time I read anything, I hear Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
In my head, actually, it's sort of a composite of Humphrey Bogart and Edward G. Robinson with a little bit of who was that guy?
Rich Little thrown in.
No, not Rich Little.
Jimmy
and
Stewart.
By the way, you can buy
Jimmy Stewart. Yeah.
No, that'd be more over here.
I think the thing that I like about the noir tale, especially in noir movies, is the fact that these are usually movies that don't conform to what a lot of the Hollywood system movies were like, where it always ends with a happy ending. And the noir tales, sometimes the good guy doesn't win. Sometimes the dame that he's in love with, he has to kill or turn in, or perhaps the character that you're rooting for actually dies. And it's, so it's very gritty and it's very, I don't know, the whole fact that most of the ones that I like are in black and white and very contrasty and stark and really stand out on the screen compared to movies that came later and that were in color, just really feel, I don't know, more real, more interesting. I mean, look at, what was the other one? The, not Sunset Boulevard, which kind of falls into that, but the other Detective Dashiell Hammett movie. I'll think about it in a moment. But it follows the same kind of idea. Or even if you're watching a lot of the Hitchcock films, it falls into the same idea. So when we read books like this, I love it because this gets into the heart of colorful language, right? Where you really start to layer adjective upon adjective to describe a certain situation. And you might spend a long time.
She was a blonde, the kind of blonde that'd make a bishop kick a hole in a stained glass window.
But not as crazy as that. But you get the you get that kind of idea. And in Maltese Falcon especially, you see a lot of that. And even in Death in the Chinatown Death Cloud Peril, you see that as well. As far as the pulpy stuff goes, I've talked before about how I got into Doc Savage and just the pure love of reading a lot of those tales from back
well,
in the day.
Doc Savage got into you.
And I just find it, you know, fascinating to read these books from back then and see how they've influenced everything since then. So that's what I like about noir and pulp. Rodrigo?
Definitely. I think it's interesting, you know, the Maltese Falcon, the book, The Maltese Falcon, is kind of retroactively noir because, it's noir because of noir film.
Right.
Or film noir. But since The Maltese Falcon itself is such a staple of film noir, it's kind of hard to read through this. And even if you haven't seen the movie, of not thinking of it like it's in black and white.
Right.
Except maybe doing that, like, Sin City thing where, like, when they start describing the chick with red hair, like, you actually see her hair is red.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I don't know, Wacko Warner's nose. I'm not sure. And The Maltese Falcon specifically, there's just something about the crime fiction book, like even Agatha Christie stuff and all that stuff is like, is this kind of very cool, but very specifically imperfect central character. You know, if you read Sam Spade's description, I believe at one point the Dashiell Hammett actually says he looked rather like a blonde Satan.
Yes.
Like, he is ugly. He's an ugly guy.
Right.
Or what's when his name? Hercule Poirot is ugly. Like, these guys are not, like, they're cool.
Right.
But they're cool because they don't conform to society.
Right, right.
You know, at a time when people were trying to be like really slick and really cool and a lot, you know, like their own kind of jazzy cool.
Right.
These guys are kind of ugly guys that are taking care of business.
Mm-hmm.
And that character is now kind of out of control in current media.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, under the restraint of a society that was not very permissive,
right.
Was a really interesting, really cool character to read about.
Well, and we'll talk about that when we get to The Maltese Falcon later in the show because, man, some of the stuff that, if you're familiar with the movie, when you read the book, you're like, whoa, they really wrote about that in magazines that you could buy for 10 cents? So one of the cool things about the pulp era is that, I guess to me, in how characters like Doc Savage and the Shadow and the Crimson or the Avenger and some of these others were just these Smith and Street churned out every month books and literally 100,000 words or whatever it is length books in a month's time. And the fact that every time it came out, you would see Lester Dent as writing as Kenneth Robeson. And what was who wrote The Shadow? What was it? Not Walter Gibson, but what was the real name of The Shadow's writer, Matthew? Do you remember?
I thought it was Walter Gibson.
No, he wrote maybe under a pen name as well. I want to say, he was actually drummed up by as a, by Smith and Street. By Smith and Street.
Street and Smith, yeah.
I guess it was created by Walter Gibson.
Walter Gibson.
Yeah, but I could have swore he went under a different name as well on the covers. But it doesn't matter. The fact is that oftentimes a lot of these people that were using the name Kenneth Robeson or Walter Gibson or whatever were
Maxwell Grant.
Yeah, Maxwell Grant. That's right. Ghostwriter.
There you go.
Underneath that. I thought it was Grant. I was going to say Max Grant, but that didn't sound right for some reason. But yeah, Max Grant.
You were right.
They were just ghostwriting it. And so while Walter Gibson and Lester Dent wrote a huge chunk of these tales. Mm-hmm. They didn't write everything. And then so when you actually, to me, for years, I kept going, when I first discovered Doc Savage and was reading through it, I was like, man, this Kenneth Robeson guy, I've got to find more of his stuff. And I kept reading it and kept reading it. And then at one point I saw a book cover, I don't know if it was a reprint from the 60s or a new collection in the 80s that said, by Lester Dent. And I was like, what the hell is this Lester Dent guy? And then started to discover a lot about what was going on in the publishing industry back then and how even cutthroat it was mm-hmm. back then for writers to nab a really cool title. And that's kind of what prompted, I think, Paul Malmont to write The Chinatown Death Cloud Peril, in which he takes these characters,
mm-hmm.
not the characters of Doc Savage and The Shadow,
but the writers,
but
who
takes
were writing.
The writers who are writing about these characters and spins off a fantastic pulp tale. Now, as I mentioned back in February, I attacked The Chinatown Death Cloud Peril from Paul Malmont, and he does have a great love for pulp, and we'll talk about his current tie into comic books in just a little bit. And Chinatown is really an attempt for him to bring back those thrilling adventures from yesteryear, but in a really unique twist. So instead of featuring the characters that we know from the pulp books, Malmont tells a really cool tale that features the authors of these pulp tales having their own adventures. So in the pages of this book, we meet Lester Dent, the creator of Doc Savage, Walter Gibson, who of course created The Shadow, L. Ron Hubbard is one of the characters in the book. He goes around calling himself The Flash with a capital T.
Nice.
And so the first time I read The Flash, I was like, who in the heck is he talking about? You know, The Flash did this, and The Flash just feels like this. And then I had to go back and reread and go, holy crap, we're seeing inside the mind of L. Ron Hubbard. I thought that was amazing. We get to meet, we're going to meet a couple of the other characters, but I'll tell you about that in a little bit. What happens is these writers are trying to best themselves, and who can dream up the best pulp tale? And we end up as readers learning about the Sweet Flower War, this gang war that happened in Chinatown that ended with this mysterious locked room mystery. And I don't know if this was a real tale that Malmont researched or if this was something he cooked up for this book. But it gets the writers thinking about, well, how did this really happen? How could you take this real tale and turn it into a pulp tale by creating this fantastical ending? And they kind of start to all think, how can I write this and best the other person? And L. Ron Hubbard wants to get out of writing the Western tales, the 10-cent Westerns, and get up to the slick print magazines where Dent and Gibson are at. And of course, Gibson, at one point we learn, screwed over Dent in a story. And of Dent really having these problems of dealing with Gibson, just hates the man, and how they all try to be very competitive with one another. And so with no real resolution in these real life events, Gibson and Dent go about trying to figure out how the murder was really committed. And as they go about their adventures, we get introduced to the fact, well, we don't get introduced to the character until much later, but we discover that H.P. Lovecraft has died. Mm-hmm. And Walter Gibson has to go to his funeral and take care of him. And when he and L. Ron Hubbard, who for whatever reason wants to tag along, I guess he thinks he's going to get, I guess some of this writing charm is going to rub off on him or whatever. They go to Providence, Rhode Island to attend his funeral, and there the duo learn about this black frigate that has this sense of evil about it.
Nice.
And possibly a bunch of zombies roaming around the streets at night in the towns of Providence. And it gets a little weird after that. If zombies don't already trick you out.
It gets weird.
It gets weirder than that.
That's
only
the point where L. Ron Hubbard is teamed up with Lester Dent to go to the funeral
of H.P. Lovecraft,
it gets weird for you.
Now, Lester Dent and his wife, Nora, they take a completely different route, and they explore the nature of Chinatown itself. They have some good friends down in Chinatown. They go down there all the time, and there they uncover this opium den in this abandoned theater that serves as a front for this Chinese warlord who is trying to plot to take control over Mao and was the other guy that took over in China. Essentially, he wants the communists out, and he wants to set himself up as a ruler. And the two stories end up eventually dovetailing with one another, and they do it very nicely into the final act of the book, and it just turns into this huge grand adventure that has Gibson haunted by the specter of the shadow, or his belief of what is the shadow. And he ends up becoming the real hero of the story by saving half of New York from this literal death cloud that is going to kill everyone. Now, before this is all over, I said there were a few other authors that make their appearance. Now, We mentioned the death of H.P. Lovecraft, but are you prepared for zombie H.P. Lovecraft?
Nice.
Are you ready for Robert Heinlein to appear in the story? Are you ready even for Orson Welles to make an appearance in the story?
How about Howard?
Howard does not, at least in my memory.
I think Howard may have been already dead.
There are a couple of characters that go by a different name. I'm almost certain that Asimov or Bradbury or one of these other sci-fi pulp writers of that time period were about to pop up. If given just a few more pages, they would have done it. And there's one character that's a cowboy character that I know I should know, but I just can't figure out who he is. And it's not Will Rogers, and it's not, you know, Hopalong Cassidy or anything like that. But it may be somebody rather important, and it just slipped my mind. The Chinatown Death Club Peril is a great adventure story, but it's also a story that talks about love and marriage, what it means to be a father, an absentee father, and really what it means to be a hero and what you're willing to do to go to become that hero and set aside all of your current positions in life. And Gibson, in his position, is very wealthy, owns his own train car, can travel anywhere that he wants, has his own manservant just taking care of that train car 24/7 so that whenever he's ready to roll, he's there. He's got his own essential driver, very much like the Shadow had his own taxi cab driver.
Nice.
He has his own driver that shows up to take him wherever he wants to go. But the problem is we're really screwing around with history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Malmont has an interesting take on history. It's clear he's done his research necessary to make the city of New York and the characters really breathe, but he does take a lot of liberties with them. I don't know if Gibson and Dent ever met each other in real life. Don't know if they ever met L. Ron Hubbard in real life. But it's this historical fact mixed with factual fiction that makes you wonder just how much of this story is true. So you're going to have to, if you want to find out what's real and what's not real, you're going to have to do some history lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the case of the zombies, I'll give you a little hint. Has to do with a form of mustard gas left over from World War I that the military is trying to sell to the Chinese,
nice.
Which turns you into a melting-faced, out-of-control zombie-type character.
Nice.
And while Gibson does come off as the hero of the book, Malmont takes the Lester Dent approach when telling this pulp story, because this mustard war gas, you know, this toxic gas is really based on science. And that's what Lester Dent wrote all of his Doc Savage stuff. There was very little mystical. It always had a scientific explanation. And that's what he does in this story. And even though most of the book has the central characters apart from one another, the story is really crafted well. I mean, there's moments where you might wonder where the heck the story is going, especially when it diverts all of a sudden to China and you're following this guy in China and you're like, how did we make this jump from this chapter to this chapter? But it all comes together in the end, and it comes together perfectly. And it's only when you reach this last page that you really see how well laid out Malmont did with this story. For fans of pulp, I think this book is going to entertain you, even though I may have spoiled part of the ending for you. But as soon as the real reader realizes that this is really a pulp tale, you automatically know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
The heroes are going to win, the bad guys are going to die, and of course you can't have L. Ron Hubbard get cacked in chapter two, because that's just not how it would play out in history.
Right.
Right? Let's see. The bad guy disappears. You know, he does make his escape to where maybe, just maybe, there could be a sequel to this book, but really, I don't want to see a sequel to this book. It really stands alone as a tale that deserves really a good place on your bookshelf. As I mentioned, this book came out in 2007. I can't believe I waited until this long to actually sit down and enjoy this book.
Well, it had no pictures.
Well, no, it didn't. And really, when you read the first chapter and you're reading about the Sweet Blossom or the Sweet Lotus War or whatever it was, you almost get lost in the telling of that tale, because it's just like, this is just too much to try to keep track of. But as you move through the book, I was even taking notes here and there trying to keep the character straight. Once you get past maybe the first three or four chapters, then everything settles down in place. As I said before, it's clear that Malmont understands pulp tales, which is why I was really excited, and here's the comic book connection. He is the writer currently writing DC's Doc Savage series, and I think that's really cool. A lot of the feeling from the Chinatown Death Cloud Peril is reflected in the current Doc Savage Savage series, which, again, makes this trip down into the pulp reader world such a fun experience. What I am surprised about, though, is that no major spoilerites when we announced this back in February, has ever read this book.
Yeah.
Because no comments were made about this over the last 2 months. And so spoiler rights, if you're looking for a good book to read, pick up the Chinatown Death Cloud Peril right now. I highly recommend it. It'll look good on your bookshelf. But if you don't want to drop a few bucks on the book, then I say just head on down to your local library and check it out. I'm giving the Chinatown Death Cloud Peril 4 stars.
Nice.
It's really good. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the April book of the month, Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. All right. So that was Chinatown Death Cloud Peril. But probably the king of all noir books has to be the Maltese Falcon.
There are no actual falcons in it.
Rodrigo, give us a breakdown.
Tequila Mockingbird, there isn't any actual tequila.
What? All right, so like I did with Chinatown, why don't you break us down with the Dashiell Hammett?
All right, so the Maltese Falcon is a story about Sam Spade. Sam Spade is a private eye. He's got a partner that he private eyes around with named Archer.
Right.
And this woman who acts innocent, but to Sam's keen skills looks like a trouble, walks in and says, I need you to find my sister.
Oh, my sister. Oh, does she come out and say that she's Bridget O'Shaughnessy in this?
No, she starts out as Miss Wonderly.
Oh, that's right. Miss Wonderly. Oh, you gotta find my sister. She's been run off with a man.
That's right.
My parents are coming back from New York. Oh, please, please, sir, help me, help me.
Yep. So he's like, all right, the money's good.
Yeah, like a lot of money for that time. I mean, he even purposefully overcharges her to see how far she'll go in that.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, Sam Spade is out for himself. He's no super duper pulp hero. He's out for his own gains.
Right.
I think it's Sam Sade, isn't it? Like that singer from the 80s?
No, not Sade. Sorry, Matthew.
Sade. It's a P in there.
So he goes out, starts investigating. He sends out his partner to start sniffing around. Right. And his partner gets killed.
Oh, it's terrible. My partner dies. Oh, woe is me. Oh, woe is me.
And of course, he hated his partner.
Yes, which we find out.
Which we find out later. And the police like him for the murder.
Right.
And they like the guy he's investigating. And the police are just kind of not very good.
The police just come off as a bunch of buffoons.
They really do. You know, and they're not very good at their job. They're kind of just trying to pin this on someone so they can just be rid of this case already.
It doesn't help Spade's case that he was doinking his former partner's wife. And that's the thing I mentioned in the previous segment, the thing that I was really surprised about, because if you've watched the movie, there's a little kissy-kissy here. Not a much.
Right.
But man, they go into some detail. Not a lot of detail, but they talking about some sexy getting it on action in this book.
Oh, yeah.
Which for the time, when this book came out in 29... That's probably, I wonder if they had to put this book, The Black Mask, which was the magazine that Maltese Falcon appeared in. I wonder if that had to be an under-the-counter book,
or if that was right there on top
of the stands.
The Maltese Falcon, the book is sexy, it's violent.
Very violent.
It doesn't sugarcoat anything. Mm-hmm. Sam Spade is the hero, he's the main character, but he kills people.
Yeah, he does. He's not afraid to punch.
There are times when his life is in danger and he reacts like somebody would if their life is in danger.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else shows up at his place and he's like, you got to find me this Maltese Falcon, man.
Joel Cairo.
That's right.
Which, you know,
you cannot separate him from
Peter Lorre.
Just like what Matthew, I don't know if it was saying in this recording, but pre-talk that... Matthew, you have a hard trouble reading anything that Sam Spade would say outside of the Humphrey Bogart voice.
I have trouble reading any noir story outside. Philip Marlowe, whatever it is, it's for some reason it's always got that kind of a Bogart thing to it, see? With a little bit of that Edward G. Robinson, see? That's how it goes in my head, yeah.
Which, again, follows that long, proud tradition of, you know, here's an ugly, hard-boiled detective in the book, which is then... played by a very clean-cut movie star,
right?
In the movie,
at least it was Bogart. I mean, Bogart was about as close as big and ugly. True. as you would ever get.
Well, what's interesting is the Humphrey Bogart movie was not the first movie of the Maltese Falcon. There was one made in, I think Maltese Falcon was 41, and there was one made 1931. Yes, that had Ricardo Corlez as Sam Spade. And that was a pre-code production, so I would really like to see a 1931 version, see how closely it ties with this, because pre-code, you could get away with a lot more stuff than you could in the code version with Humphrey Bogart. So,
oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so this grand story that we learn about the about this bird, this thing that dreams are made of, or whatever
that's
that they
right.
say.
It is so valuable that shut up, it's valuable. That's how valuable it is.
And there's a good section of the book where they go into describing the whole history of the bird and its value and everything, but something's not straight with that Joel Cairo guy.
That's right. And if you've seen the movie, you know, not straight might be the way to go with it, but that's not important. Like, he's supposed, well, and he's supposed to come across as just sleazy in every way, and they talk about the way he smells, and he's all perfumed and effeminate and stuff like that, which, you know, back then would have definitely led you to not trust somebody.
Right, you know?
Like, they definitely play to all that stuff as him being foreign and weird and effeminate, and he smells good, which is not how you want a man to smell, I guess. Exactly.
The complete opposite of Sam Spade.
Of Sam Spade, exactly.
Right.
In fact, it's funny. Yes, he looks like Chardet. his love is king. So, we finally meet, I believe, Cairo tries to search his office and Spade beats him up.
Right.
And we start discovering connections between all these characters.
Right.
Between him and Gutman.
Right. This new character, yeah.
Right. Who is the fat man for a long time until we finally find out his name.
And his name is Gutman.
That's right. This kind of fiction.
Yeah.
You know, it really, like, here's a character, you know, Sam Spade. Who is Sam Spade?
Let's call it a spade a spade. He's going to call it like it is.
Exactly.
Let's talk about
it like it is. He is sharp. He is an angular man. He is described as a cone, basically.
Yeah. Let's talk about the foreigner, Cairo.
That's right.
Let's talk about the fat man, Gutman.
That's right. The redhead is called Bridget O'Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's to a certain degree, it's, you know, that kind of determinism. It's that kind of, you know, a man named Otto Octavius becomes Dr. Octopus kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's a name for that, but I think it is determinism. I don't know. I forget what it is. Yes, we start seeing connections between Cairo, Gutman, and Bridget O'Shaughnessy, who we find out is Miss Wonderly's real name.
Right.
And that she is, you know, just as big of a scumbucket or bigger than the other two. And she's in it to get this bird as well.
Right. And nobody knows where the bird is. Apparently it was supposed to come in on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
Ship burns. Meanwhile, the police are still hounding Sam Spade over this death. Mm-hmm. He's trying to protect himself. He's trying to figure out, again, looking out for himself, how can he make some money on this deal?
Yep.
He's already been promised $5,000 for the recovery of this bird. He tries to negotiate for more money. And after he finds out what it is, he definitely wants more money.
Mm.
And you start to see some things click in his head as you read this book. It's not, Dashiell Hammett doesn't spell out exactly everything that's going on in Sam Spade's head. Otherwise, it would ruin the story. But we start
and
to see.
And it is a third-person narration, which is, you know.
Which is helpful.
Right. Yeah.
And but it does stay firmly with Sam Spade throughout the whole piece. Mm. Everything that we hear of, this fire that took place on the ship, or the meeting that Gutman, Cairo, and O'Shaughnessy had on the ship, are all told through a secondary account from someone else of this is what we think happened.
That Sam hears, the narrator never leaves Sam, I believe.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I kind of like that kind of storytelling because does leave open a lot of interpretation
of what's
going on.
It makes for a good detective story.
Right.
It kind of prevents your detective from making ridiculous intuitive leaps.
Yeah.
Right.
Which, you know, up until, like, Sherlock, you know, which even though for a while detective fiction had actual deduction and actual piecing together of stuff, there was still plenty of knockoff detective fiction that was just like, here's this huge leap.
A to B to C
and,
to D.
And backwards we're going to explain why it's true, but not how the
Sherlock
detective
Holmes
came up with it.
Sherlock Holmes had a lot of that. That was a lot of problem with reading Sherlock Holmes.
It's stuff that borders on the supernatural, like basically them having, you know, ESP.
Yeah, powers far beyond that. Mental powers far beyond the normal man. What's interesting, though, is as you say, we're taking these great leaps. I think Hammett falls into this trap in this book because everybody's looking for the bird, and then all of a sudden, Captain Jacoby, coincidentally, whatever, shows up at Sam Spade's door with the bird and dies. Right? That to me is I had a problem with that.
A bit of a deus ex machina.
Yeah, it was, because it's like, okay, it's like almost, and I don't remember if this story appeared in multiple versions of Black Mask magazine, or if the whole book appeared in one magazine. I'm not quite sure on how.
I doubt it.
Because, you know, a lot of the pulp tales would be serialized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a serialization.
Some of them would be self-contained, like the Doc Savage and the Shadow stuff were all self-contained in one magazine.
This one was a serialization.
It had to have been serialization. So I don't know if the editor was finally said, Hammett, get to the point, and this is where Captain Jacoby comes into the picture. It'd be interesting. And your book, Rodrigo, was it broken down into
chapters?
Well, I mean, it's broken down into chapters, but was it broken down into segments, like books, book one, book two, book three, which would have appeared in the magazine that way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
It's broken down into chapters, and the chapters are titled
in
super cool ways.
Yeah.
Like,
what's one of the last
every
chapters?
Crackpot.
Yeah, yeah.
And, The Third Murder.
O'Shaughnessy and Spade get it on.
The Emperor's Gift.
Yeah, yes. O'Shaughnessy and Spade get it on. There's a mysterious figure following them around as Spade is trying to piece together who's killing who, some wiry kid guy.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes that after Jacoby dies and Spade runs off to try to figure out what's going on. We haven't really mentioned the secretary.
Effie,
very much in here. Yeah. And she's a unique character in herself, too, because she knows that Spade is sleeping with Archer's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the same time, there's hints and allusions that she might have been the love of Spade at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But she's also somewhat gullible in that she gets a phone call and swears up and down that it's O'Shaughnessy calling and saying, oh, Sam, you got to rush and go to her rescue, only to find out that it's a trap.
There's a trap.
But Spade does something very smart in that he goes and mails the bird to himself or puts it in a locker where he can't get it until a certain point of time.
Yep.
And then everybody winds back up in Spade's apartment. And this is way at the very end of the book.
And the police show up.
The police haven't shown up yet because this is the weird part. And this is the part of the book that I just did not care for at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sam solves, and I don't know what page it's on. It's different on the books. Yeah. Sam solves all the murders. Hey, this guy killed Archer. This guy killed the other guy that he was following. Whatever.
You hired this guy to kill this other guy?
Yes. Floyd Thursby. You killed Thursby. You killed my partner, Archer. You did this. You did this. Here's how you're connected. And at that point, I kept going, why is there so much more of this book going on? You know, it's almost like two more chapters, I think, in this book. And so they decide to wait out in Archer's room for until morning when he can go pick up the bird. And we have to read about the whole night, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's the part of the book I just couldn't stand. I was like, come on, get on with it. We already know who killed who and how Sam is setting everyone up. And then it becomes a mental game between the characters.
Yeah.
Until finally the police show up, and then certain people have run off, certain people arrested. You know, some people are dead. Cairo and the skinny guy are dead, right? Or is Cairo?
I can't remember. The kid.
Yeah, the kid.
I'm pretty sure the kid dies.
Yeah, he dies.
Wilmer's dead, yeah.
I can't remember if Cairo dies or not, but, you know, Gutman is off to Istanbul or wherever, where he thinks the bird might show up next. Mm-hmm. And O'Shaughnessy is maybe going to go with him, but doesn't. And
right.
It just turns into this, the tragic part of these kind of tales is the hero and the girl don't end up together at the end.
Oh, yeah. The story's over, but it's not like the hero wins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, he talks back to her when she says that, hey, I'm in love with you. And he knows that she's full of crap.
Him.
Yeah. And essentially just turns her over. And he turns over O'Shaughnessy as Archer's killer. He blames Wilmer for
shooting Gutman.
Shooting Gutman. Later on, that's when they catch up with Wilmer. Mm-hmm. But I think Wilmer killed Thursby. And then when they go to get Wilmer, he's already killed Gutman.
Yeah.
And everybody dies, essentially. And it's, I don't know.
You didn't like that? Yes. You didn't like the way that it ended?
No, I liked how it ended because it's very typical of the books that we see in this. I just don't like the whole chapter that we had to read or the two chapters that we had to read of, and then the next hour ticked by and the sun had not come up yet. And then Gutman said, oh, do you think that that it's open, that you can retrieve the bird yet? Ah, give me another hour. And then we have to read about another hour that passes. Mm-hmm. And we see the little mind games going on to that. But I don't think we had to read that for as long as we had to read it. Mm-hmm. That was my main frustration with this book. What happens with the bird?
What does happen with
the bird? It is not really spelled out in the book. You know, we know it's been mailed off to somebody, but, mm-hmm. you know, Spade being Spade, you'd think that he'd go and retrieve the bird and he would have it.
I think he gives the bird to the cops.
Yeah, isn't there something about the bird not being as valuable as, or not?
Yeah, that it's a fake, yeah, because it's a fake. Gutman tries to smash it, and he's like, wait, it's a fake! It's a trap! Bah, 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 bah. It's a fake! Yeah, that's it. But still, I don't know. That section of the book, the just waiting section, kills it for me. The ending I thought was great, especially when Spade turns on O'Shaughnessy and just gives her the old what for.
Yeah,
and essentially says, here's what a terrible person you are. I may be bad, but you're worse.
Yeah.
And turns her over to the cops, and then he and Effie, I don't know, seems like they're going to go get it on.
But they don't.
Yeah, they don't.
I mean, honestly, and the real ending of the book, yeah, she's disgusted by him. He's, you know, she's like, I know you did what you needed to do, but, you know, I just can't be around you right now.
Yeah, and then Archer's wife shows back up.
Yeah.
And that's like, come on, I thought you dealt with her already. But, yeah, it just is kind of, like, continues.
I like that. I like that. And, like, that ending where she's, like, where she is reminded of the kind of man that he is. And that, well, he's not a bad man, but is, like, he is that guy, once again, who doesn't fit into society, who does what he needs to do to A, survive, and B, get the job done,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's always looking out for himself. And it's like, you know, from beginning to end, it's interesting because from beginning to end, Sam Spade is Sam Spade. He doesn't have a lot of character growth. He doesn't change. It's always him, like, but it's okay because, you know, from his perspective, which is pretty much what you always have, the world is changing around him.
Right.
It's not like he has discovered this world and now he needs to become a different person to deal with it, like, you know, most narratives go. Mm-hmm. It's he is this person who is in this little box and the world, like everything he knows about the world, just flips over every other page.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to actually maintain his own personal code of whatever, ethics and integrity and whatever. And as this world kind of flip-flops and keeps throwing him curveballs.
And he's probably hardened from the war, World War I. I'm sure he was involved in that because this came out in, like I said, 29. So he would be, as old as he's portrayed in the book, he's someone that's probably seen some horrors and is not shaken by that.
Yep.
The fact that Effie wants to continue to work with him and just doesn't say, you know, I quit, is also a surprise. Oh, says a lot about her.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
and they've probably had situations like maybe not quite as big as this.
Right.
Because this is, you know, presumably the biggest case of Sam Spade's life, or otherwise it wouldn't be as interesting.
Right.
But, you know, similar situations where she sees that her charismatic and, you know, in her own eyes, really interesting boss is actually kind of a bad man.
Yeah, kind of a dick.
Yep.
Yeah. Matthew,
a private dick.
Yay, I see what you did there. Matthew, you've been kind of quiet. You want to throw in some thoughts or reactions to after reading this book? I don't know, how many times have you read this book before?
Never. And what? I'm going to be honest with you. I did read this kind of hurriedly.
Sure.
Because I didn't get my copy until about 2 days after the last time we planned to actually read it.
Oh, okay.
So, but I, being more familiar with the movie, I do like a couple of things. I like the way they go into depth on certain aspects of the characters, but then they don't ever come out and explain what's really going on in Sam's head. It's a third person narrative. So it's not like I'm the best there is at what I do. It's not like, you know, there's a flat out explanation. I'm not clear at the end whether he's a good guy hanging out with bastards to try and get in with the bastards so he can find out what bastardry they're up to and bust them, or if he really is one of the bastards who's trying to pass himself off as one of the good guys.
That is kind of the, what I think Hammett's trying to let you decide at the end of the book.
He definitely walks the line, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, this appeared in Black Mask magazine, which was not, you know, was not a top tier title at the time. So he, I don't know. There's another book. I bought it. I haven't had a chance to read it. It'll probably go on the stack at some point. It's called Moral Vision, written by George J., quote unquote, Rhino Thompson. It is the most, according to the cover, the most influential full-length investigation of Dashiell Hammett's novels, including Red Harvest, The Dane Curse, The Maltese Falcon, and The Glass Key and The Thin Man. And I wanted to go through and read what this in-depth analysis was, because I'm going to bet that Hammett may not have been thinking, hey, you, the reader, have to make your choice of whether he is a good guy. Like you said, Matthew, is he a good guy slumming with the scums, right, or is he a scummy guy trying to make good with the cops and in right, society? I don't know.
It seems like there's...
How do you see him as?
Well, I have trouble not seeing him as Humphrey Bogart. And I feel like there was a clearer... There was kind of, to me at least, it felt like a clearer narrative line in the movie version that Spade was hanging out with, you know, the bastards to get to the bastards.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I was kind of surprised by that cynicism and that lack of, you know, that lack of, here's your hero character and this is what he does to get by. It really is our protagonist even a hero? Is he, you know, he's willing to play both sides against the middle. And at one point he says flat out that he hated Archer.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing about this is this man's partner, and you think, in my mind, it's a revenge thing. It's get back for the man who got the man who was your partner and your pal. But he's like, you know, I despised him. I'm like, wait a minute. How did, you know, so again, it's that dichotomy at the character. He's willing to go to these ends and do all of these things that are at the very least questionable in the name of a man that you never really seemed to even like.
I just coincidentally flipped to the page in this book. If you wouldn't permit me to read like two paragraphs, Rodrigo.
Don't get us sued.
It's only two paragraphs. Few critics agree on how we should take the ending. And this is the author. But I argue that the final confrontation between Sam Spade and Bridget O'Shaughnessy represents more clearly than any other in Hammett's writing the nature and scope of his moral vision. Spade's rejection of Bridget is at once pragmatic and moral, and is a measure of Hammett's artistic development that he shows these to be interrelated and interdependent. In Red Harvest, the pragmatic strain dominated, and the implication was the action in the real world had little or no functional relationship to the moral concerns. Then he goes on to say something about the Dane Curse. In The Maltese Falcon, there is equal emphasis on the necessity of knowing the real world as it is and on acting according to the principles. Such a reading, however, is clearly at odds with most of the critical estimates of the novel. We're told by one commentator, for example, that Spade is, quote, almost totally amoral and almost cruel, and by another that Sam Spade is simply one of Hammett's tough guys, as amoral or immoral as his antagonist. Robert Edenbaum sees the novel as a battle between villainesses, who is a woman of sentiment and thrives on the sentiment of others, and a hero who has none and who survives because he has none. He would have us believe that Spade's unscrupulousness is the subject of the novel, and he argues that Spade knows Bridget is guilty from the beginning and that he uses her and manipulates her throughout. Irving Mallon, on the other hand, sees Spade as an elusive and indefinable character, one who shares the archetypal qualities of such mystical heroes as Odysseus, Samuel, Jesus, and who yet seems to lack discernible motives for his actions. So I guess it's, again,
I think
critics are going to disagree on this interpretation.
And they're clearly, from all those interpretations, they're pretty split.
Yeah. Rodrigo, how do you see Sam Spade?
I see Sam Spade as a man who lives in a rat's nest. And he's doing what he needs to do to get by. What does he need to get by? He needs money.
Yeah.
And he needs to not get thrown in jail by the cops.
Yeah.
And throughout, to me, it's pretty clear throughout this whole thing, you know, as the plot begins to unfold, that he does everything in his power, whether that is to manipulate other people and whether that is to kill other people mm-hmm. or pin stuff on other people
right.
to A, survive, and B, get to the bottom of this thing that's causing him problems. You know, Sam Spade doesn't have a, you know, 6-year-old daughter.
Right.
He doesn't have anybody to who looks up to him. He's alone. Even his secretary is very disconnected from him.
Right.
Like, he has no one else in the world except for himself, and he is just doing everything that he needs to get by.
And that bottle of whiskey next to his table.
That's right. So from that sense, is he a hero? Is he a villain? He's not either. He's a survivor. He's basically trying to get to the end of this book alive.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. And that's very interesting to me. It's, yeah. you know, once you strip a person down to their bare essentials, what do they do? And honestly, he makes a moral, like, and by that I mean like a positively moral decision in the end to turn in Bridget. You know, he's saying, this is, you know, to me, I know, even if it's not like that, he knows that she's playing him mm-hmm. because she might not be at right. that point. You know, he still says, and I'm going to turn you in because that's the way to get to the end of this and because you deserve to be turned in.
Right. At the same time, I still think that maybe he's thinking in the back of his head, I don't need this crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This crazy following me around. I see Sam Spade as an opportunist looking out for just himself mm-hmm. and trying to make a big buck at the end. And, you know, he could have had the big money at the end, but he tossed it all away, which I thought was interesting for somebody yeah. that's always trying to look out for himself. So, Rodrigo, give us a summary of Sam Spade, if you would, or the Maltese Falcon, if you would. What your thoughts are and...
I really like this book. It's... You know, when I was in college, I took a couple literature classes, and The Maltese Falcon was actually one of the few books that I actually read all the way through. Others I skimmed, some I looked up online, just, you know, because, you know, the Scarlet Letter, whatever. But I've read it, and I've read it more than once, which is extremely rare for me. And
yeah.
if you want to have fun with the Maltese Falcon, cast your friends as the characters.
Oh boy, who am I?
And then I cast them the first time. I'm
Floyd Thursby, huh? Nobody ever meets me, and I'm just dead.
Yeah, pretty much. You just show up dead.
You're Archer.
And just watch in your own brain how, because that's a good, you know, from your first impression, say, oh. You know, Bridget O'Shaughnessy is like that attractive chick from Human Resources, right? I know her. She's mysterious. She's kind of nice to me. Just cast her. And like, as this stuff unfolds, you're like, holy crap, I can't believe she did this to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Like, it's actually a fun game to play with detective novels. And I've done it before. And it's actually, especially with The Maltese Falcon, which is a very well-written one.
Right.
And with Sam Spade, who's kind of a blank slate.
Right.
Aside from being, you know, and obviously that's you, whoever right. you are, right. assuming you're a boy and you don't, or you're a
you
girl.
You can be a girl, I suppose, with a...
You know, and you don't mind casting yourself as Sam.
Sam yeah. is a, you know, an asexual right. name.
Samantha Spade.
Have you read the prequel book that was written just a few years ago called no. Sam and Archer? I was debating whether to get that. Matthew, go ahead with what your thoughts are on the Maltese Falcon.
I think, for me, my favorite part is when Cairo and Gutman step out of the holodeck and have to watch themselves completely disappear because they're hollow matter and the Haradin have arrived. And of course the holodeck gets fixed, but that actually explains my point. This is prototypical, not just, you know, this is not early. This is not like, oh, this is how you do it. This is prototypical to me. This yep. is how
Definitely.
Noir became noir. This is
right.
this is before Philip Marlowe.
Yeah.
This is you know, for me, this is the polarizing moment.
It's
this is
German
your first real hard boiled. Yeah. It's, you know, it was before Davy Jones was even born. This is the first hard boiled novel. This is the thing that, you know, that Frank Miller wants to grow up and be.
Yeah.
If you look at it from a comic book perspective
yeah,
and you
right,
say,
right.
I sure do like me some Sin City, I would say read this. Now, the yeah. one, only, and I will say the only problem for me is not a question of mobility or a question of, you know, how am I going to sit down? It's a question of when am I going to get enough time to sit down and read 200 pages. Yada yada pages, you know?
12
that's
my copy.
That's the most difficult part for me was time to actually sit down and read it. And as a speed reader, I can go through something and process most of the material, but a lot of the heavy detail that you guys went into may have avoided me. You know, yeah. It may have gotten above my level, but I can tell you that
we're reading it fast enough to where some of the details fall out of our heads too.
And the good thing about the Maltese Falcon is that it's a pretty straightforward book. Obviously there's twists and turns, but the prose that it's written in is very surface. Yes. You know, it doesn't use gigantic words that you have to look up. It is all
common,
you know,
man.
Yeah. Short descriptive sentences, and he gets a lot of mileage out of, you know, comparing somebody to a teacup, you know.
Right.
And it's interesting to me that this is there are things that you would not expect even for the second that would be influenced by this. You realize there's a character in the Danger Mouse cartoon who is based partially on Gutman.
Yep.
Baron Silas Greenback is based on and actually named after partly named after the actor who played Gutman in the 1941 movie adaptation. So, I mean, this is something to where these have become, this story and these characters have become archetypical. So even if, you know, you're just bored and you want to read something and try and figure out what's going on and go, oh, okay, well, maybe I don't like noir, this is a good place to start. I do like noir. I don't have a lot of time to read books, but this is something that I sat down and wanted to read.
Yeah.
And then you made me read Battle Chasers, too.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, as Matthew said, this is something that launched every noir book, every pulpy detective's tale to come after it. And I can't help but think that James Ellroy was heavily influenced by Dashiell Hammett. Because if you read his L.A. Quartet, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. I've read two of those. I've read Black Dahlia and L.A. Confidential. It just screams time period, even though it's not the same time period. It's like 10 years after or whatever. But you can see everything that Hammett was doing, Ellroy is being influenced on in those books. And for those of you that have only seen the movie, and the movie's very well done.
Oh, yeah.
The book is so much more. And I would say this is a book that if you're as big a fan as we are into the noir and the pulp, you need to read this book. I can't believe I waited this long to read it. I was satisfied with just watching the movie once a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad I read the book. All right. Other comments, other questions?
Nope.
All right, everybody, stay tuned. On Monday, we will post the book of the month for May up on the MajorSpoilers.com website. And we really thank you for being a part of the Major Spoilers experience, even when we deviate into these different kind of topics. This is something, a show that we're not going to do all the time, but once a month, if we can sit down and talk about a book that we've read, I think we'll all be better off for it. And on Tuesday, don't forget, we're going to be back into the comic book realm, talking about something that kind of feels a little bit noirish, a little bit pulpy at the same time, but also fantastical far-out comic books. Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, or Xenozoic Tales, as it was originally known, by Mark Schultz. Why are we going to look at that? Because Rodrigo loves dinosaurs, and we know you do too, and we'll talk to you next time.
If you have any questions, comments, topic ideas for future shows, or would like to sponsor a show, send an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com. Visit majorspoilers@majorspoilers.com and be sure to check out the Major Spoilers forum. You can also follow Major Spoilers on Twitter at twitter.com/majorspoilers and on MySpace at myspace.com/majorspoilers.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. like a man of iron. Might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being the Middle East with a king, son, throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
Major Spoilers Podcast. Copyright 2010.